Les séminaires du Collège de France.
J'ai le grand plaisir de présenter Ian Roberts, professeur à l'Université de Cambridge. Ian a obtenu son doctorat à l'Université de la Californie du Sud et puis il a travaillé pendant de longues années à Genève et on s'est connus à cette occasion, on a beaucoup collaboré. Ensuite, il a été professeur à l'université de Bangor au Pays de Galles et puis à Stuttgart aussi en Allemagne et puis à Cambridge avec un passage aussi à l'école de hautes études ou de recherche avancée de l'université de Pavie. Donc Ian est un grand spécialiste de syntaxe comparative, de syntaxe diachronique. Son livre sur la syntaxe diachronique du verbe en anglais et en français est un modèle de comment il faudrait faire l'étude de la diachronie en utilisant la grammaire générative. Il a publié plusieurs monographies, dont une récente sur la théorie des paramètres, justement, en présentant les résultats du travail du groupe de recherche financé par un projet ERC à l'université de Cambridge. Et aujourd'hui, il va nous parler de cette question en présentant un cadre qu'il a développé avec Dalina Kalouli de l'université de Vienne. Bien, merci beaucoup et bienvenue.
Merci beaucoup. Je vais parler en anglais parce que c'est ma langue maternelle. Mais si vous avez besoin de, si vous voulez poser des questions en français ou si vous avez besoin d'explications en français, évidemment, il n'y a pas de problème. Anche in italiano, casomai. But I'll stick to English and try to avoid a tendency to speak too quickly. So as Luigi said, this is joint work that I'm developing. It's very new work, actually. We don't yet have a paper, but it's very new work that I'm doing in collaboration with Professor Dalina Kalouli of the University of Vienna. And we're trying to develop, as the title says, a new approach to the parameters of universal grammar. So the outline. I'll first present the notion of principles and parameters, which Luigi alluded to several times in his presentation. I'll just present the idea and give some examples. And then I'll discuss what one can consider now, I think, the standard approach to the nature of parameters, which is the so-called Borea-Chomsky conjecture, which again Luigi, in fact, mentioned. I'll then present our alternative based on the notions of redundancy and deficiency, which I'll try to define and explain, and then give some case studies, and then conclude with an intentional definition of parameters and features. So let's begin. So just to give the basic idea of parameters, one very simple, I think, but very influential idea was put forward by the Chinese linguist Jim Huang in his 1982 MIT dissertation, where he proposed that Chinese-type languages differ from English-type languages in how they form interrogatives. So in English, to form a simple WH question, as we would call it, the WH word or phrase containing a WH pronoun or determiner goes to the beginning of the sentence. So we have questions like, what did John eat? And of course, here we understand what is the direct object of eat, but it's not in the standard direct object position of English, which would be the immediately post-verbal position. That is marked instead by what is called a trace or a copy of the moved element, but which is in fact silent. On the other hand, the Chinese sentence corresponding to 1A is this. Here we see the corresponding, the word that corresponds to English what, shema, occupies the normal direct object position of Chinese, which in fact, like English, is the immediately post-verbal position. So in English, WH words move to the front of the sentence, to the beginning of the sentence, and in Chinese they don't. And we can consider this a parameter. WH questions have the same semantics and the same discourse functions in both languages, but they are syntactically distinct. This should not be terribly surprising to you, this contrast between English and Chinese, as speakers of French, because in French, in fact, we see both options. In a perhaps slightly higher register of French, we have WH movement. So the translation of A would be qu'est-ce que j'en ai mangé? But in a more colloquial variety of French, we can leave the WH word, which has a slightly different form for different reasons, in the direct object position and say something like j'en ai mangé quoi. This actually shows that the notion of parameter extends not just to cross-linguistic comparison, but to cross-dialectal or cross-register comparison in certain languages. The principle here would be that clauses must be marked for their clause type, which is related, of course, to their speech act function, as clauses must be typed as interrogatives, declaratives, imperatives, etc. The parameter is how languages do it. So WH interrogatives are typed through WH movement in languages such as English and standard French, if we can call it that, but they can also be marked by a question particle in languages such as Chinese or colloquial French. So in the Chinese example on the previous slide, we see the particle ne, which marks a WH interrogative. And in French, we can consider synchronically the combination est-ce que to be a kind of interrogative particle. The idea of principles and parameters, which developed around 1980 initially, was an important step forward in the history of generative grammatical theory because, first of all, as I hope that little example illustrates, it offered a plausible framework in which to capture the similarities and differences among languages within a rigorous formal theory. And it led to the discovery of important patterns of variation across languages. In fact, Huang's pioneering work did exactly this in relation to the comparative syntax of interrogatives. Another consequence, which in fact Huang himself pointed out at the time, and Chomsky took this up as well around that same time, it became possible, or arguably necessary, to discover properties of one language, say English or French, by studying aspects of distinct genetically unrelated languages such as Chinese or an African language such as Gongbei, and vice versa. So this led comparative generative syntax into a very different kind of intellectual world to the traditional philologies where one would be, say, an expert on French or Italian or the Romance languages and not worry about Japanese or Bantu languages or English. The spirit of comparative generative syntax causes us to pay attention, whichever language we might be speakers of and most interested in, it causes us to pay attention to analyses of other languages, which really means all other languages in principle. And most important of all, the principles and parameters approach offered an explanatory model for the empirical analyses, which opened a way to meet the challenge of Plato's problem, as Chomsky called it, posed by children's effortless yet completely successful acquisition of their grammars under the conditions of the poverty of the stimulus. Here is a quotation from the paper that Luigi just cited, actually, Hauser, Chomsky and Fitch, 2002, a very succinct slightly dense, perhaps, but very succinct statement of the poverty of stimulus. So I'll just read this through. Given a finite array of data, there are infinitely many theories consistent with it, but inconsistent with one another. In the present case, that's language acquisition, there are in principle infinitely many target systems consistent with the data of experience, and unless the search space and the acquisition mechanisms are constrained, selection among them is impossible. The difficulty of this problem leads to the hypothesis that whatever system is responsible must be biased or constrained in certain ways. Such constraints have historically been termed innate dispositions, and those underlying language referred to as universal grammar. So this is the essence of the poverty of stimulus argument, really the point in the first sentence there. Given a finite array of data, there are infinitely many theories consistent with it, but inconsistent with one another. The principles and parameters model arguably takes us a very significant step in the direction of a solution to this problem, which is sometimes called the logical problem of language acquisition, in that the otherwise formidable task of language acquisition is reduced to a matter of parameter setting. So we can think of this as what Charles Yang, a very notable worker on language acquisition who we'll meet again later, called the 20 questions model of language acquisition. So the child acquiring any given language has to take an option regarding the nature of the formation of WH interrogatives. The English child says, okay, move the WH expression to the beginning of the sentence. The Chinese acquiring child simply doesn't do that. Okay, so, and we can consider this to be a sort of repeated idea. Furthermore, the approach makes clear predictions about language typology. Parameters make predictions about language types and indeed possible language types. And finally, something I won't go into today, but as Luigi mentioned, I have done work on language change. It sets the agenda for research on syntactic change, which can be seen as a language changing the values of its parameters over time. And in actual fact, considering the question of WH interrogatives, we can see evidence across not just French, but various other Romance languages, particularly the more colloquial varieties of various kinds of Latin American Spanish and Brazilian Portuguese, for example, that there seems to be a tendency to move from a system with WH movement to a system without WH movement. So we do see parameter change in that domain too. Well, here's another example of a parameter, a slightly more abstract one, the so-called head parameter, which determines basic word order properties of languages. So if we adopt an approach to phrase structure, which actually can be reduced to merge, which Luigi just discussed, and which I'll say more about later, but essentially an approach to phrase structure in which a very core aspect of the system is the relationship between a head of one category and its phrasal complement of another category. So it's argued that there's a general constraint that these elements will always merge together and so form a constituent. But as the rule in A indicates, the rule in A is formulated with set notation, so there's no, at the universal level, there's no intrinsic preordained ordering of head and complement. A point we'll revisit towards the end of the talk, actually, but this is a standard view. So that's a principle, if you like, that heads and complements will merge together to form a constituent, but without specification as to the relative order of head and complement. And then there's a parameter which basically says a language has to choose whether the head precedes or follows its complement. This will basically give us a simple binary typology of languages in which head precedes complement versus languages in which heads follow the complement. And languages where the head precedes the complement will have the order verb direct object, auxiliary verb or verb phrase more precisely, preposition complement, and many other orders which we can call generally head initial orders. In contrast, languages which take the opposite value for this parameter where X follows YP would be languages where the object, where the verb follows the object, where the auxiliary follows the verb phrase, where we don't have prepositions but postpositions following their noun phrases. And that is a very common pattern. In fact, the two patterns are just about equally common across the world's languages, as we might expect. So languages with the head final ordering include Japanese, Korean, the Turkic languages, the Dravidian languages of southern India, and many others. And in fact, there are now some very extensive typological databases available where there's information collected by language typologists on surface patterns of thousands of languages. So this is an example from what's known from a database called the World Atlas of Language Structures. And there's a more recent database called GramBank, which has evidence from well over 2,000 languages for a whole set of morphosyntactic and indeed phonological features. And the great thing about WALS in particular, the World Atlas of Language Structures, is that one can combine features. So here's the map of the properties of the world's languages regarding the combination of object-verb order and post-positional order on the one hand versus the other combinations of the two properties, verb-object order and preposition versus post-position. And you can see that the head-final order, the one where we have object-verb and post-position, is extremely common in the world. Those are the yellow squares. You can see it's almost all of Asia, except Southeast Asia. There's a belt across the middle of Africa. There's a few languages in Papua New Guinea and Australia, and then a great deal, a large number, the majority, of the indigenous languages of North and arguably South America. Then the blue circle it represents head initial languages. That's languages with verb, object, and prepositional order. And again, you can see it's extremely common, and you can see that it's aerially distributed. So Europe, you might spot one yellow circle there in northern Spain. That's Basque. Okay, but otherwise, the whole of Europe, just about, all of sub-Saharan Africa, just about, except for a few languages in South Africa, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, the Pacific, and then the Pacific Northwest of North America, Central America, and parts of South America. And you can see that the OV postposition and VO preposition are really dominant. In actual fact, the sample here is just under 1,000 languages. So you can convert, or just under 900, you can approximately convert those figures into percentages. And so you can see that together, the head final and head initial orders represent over 80% of the languages. The other two patterns are found, however, which is an issue, but they're much less common. So you can see some red triangles there. In particular, actually, in Iran, the Iranian languages do show some unusual properties. You can also see some green diamonds, particularly in West Africa, if you look. But the basic point here is that the head parameter makes very good, not perfect, but very good typological predictions. But there is a problem with what are sometimes called disharmonic languages. The notion here is that languages can be harmonically one way or the other, harmonically head initial or harmonically head final. And actually, we don't have to look very far to find a very well-known case of a disharmonic language, namely German. Which has object-verb order, which you can see in subordinate clauses. There's a complication in main clauses that I'll perhaps talk about later. But it's largely prepositional. Actually, German does have some postpositions too. And Latin is a similar case. And then a different kind of disharmony is represented by Chinese, which has verb-object order, as I mentioned earlier, but in relative clauses, the head of the relative follows the relative clause. So instead of saying, the man I met yesterday, you say, the yesterday I met man. We also see actually micro-variation regarding typological properties, even again, just in very familiar languages. So in English, the neutral order of possessor and possessee is for the possessor to precede the possessee with the apostrophe S marking the possessor. So something like my aunt's pen. But of course, in French and the other Romance languages, the order would be the opposite. Possessee, possessor, la plume de ma tante. And actually, just a note here, some of you may know this, but I chose that example deliberately because in traditional introductions to French for English speakers, for some unknown reason, la plume de ma tante was one of the first phrases English speakers were supposed to learn, which is really bad because it contains two phonemes that are really hard for English speakers to pronounce, namely the U of plume and the nasalized vowel in tante. So most English speakers would say something like la plume de ma tante. But of course that's not correct. Moving on to another parameter, which Luigi has worked on extensively, the null subject parameter. This distinguishes languages like Italian, and in fact the majority of the Romance languages, from languages such as English and indeed French. So in Italian, to say he or she, well, he speaks Italian, we would naturally, in a normal discourse, simply say parla italiano. Right, without pronouncing a subject pronoun. You can say lui parla italiano, but that has some kind of emphasis on the subject. In English, of course, you have to include the pronoun. You can't say speaks Italian. You have to say he speaks Italian or she speaks Italian. In French, parle italien is, of course, a grammatical sentence, but it's an imperative. It's not grammatical as a declarative. So we can formulate the null subject parameter by saying, can a silent pronoun, a phonologically empty pronoun, which we write as pro, be the subject of a finite declarative clause? So the answer would be yes for Italian, no for English and French. In fact, not just Italian, but Spanish, Greek, Albanian, which is Dalina Kaluli's native language, Chinese, and many, many other languages. No, English, French, almost certainly, and in fact, all the other Germanic languages pattern with English in being non-null subject languages. Here's another example of a parameter, the so-called verb movement parameter, or verb placement parameter might be a better term for it. So here we have two sentences, English and French, and they look as though they have almost exactly the same syntax. Harry and Hermione follow Filch. Harry et Hermione, is that how you pronounce it? Hermione? Suivent Russard. So we have SVO order, we have a structure like this for the English sentence rather clearly. Again, we saw similar examples from in Luigi's presentation. But of course, if you look at the order here, sorry, if you look at this sentence, we could have the verb either in the verb position or in the tense position. In fact, we know that in English the verb is in the verb position because it follows adverbs that modify the verb phrase, such as often. So Harry and Hermione often follow Filch is a grammatical sentence of English. And in fact, the opposite order of verb and adverb here, Harry and Hermione follow often Filch, is ungrammatical. Quite sharply ungrammatical, in fact. Then if we look at the French counterpart with the adverb often, souvent, we have Harry et Hermione suivent souvent Russard. So note the order here, suivre souvent, not souvent suivre. Right? So the verb in French is not in the V position, but it moves, it's supposed to be in the T position, it moves from the V position to the T position in French. So here we have a movement parameter. English lacks this operation of V to T head movement. French has this operation. Diagnostic is adverbs and actually other materials such as negation, not in English and pas in French, whether they precede or follow the finite verb. Other languages with V movement include basically all the other Romance languages. Other languages lacking it include, again, Chinese. So those are some examples of parameters. And I hope that gives you a sense of how we can use this notion as a descriptive tool for just analysing differences among languages, but also as a theoretical tool for setting up language typologies, and most importantly, for giving a model for language acquisition. But of course, the natural question that arises is, well, what is a possible parameter? And here is where the Borea-Chomsky conjecture comes in. So this was originally, it's called the Borea-Chomsky conjecture because it was originally proposed by Hagit Borea back in 1984 and adopted and adapted by Chomsky in his monograph, The Minimalist Program from 1995, which again Luigi mentioned. And the hypothesis states that all parameters of variation are attributable to differences in the formal features of the functional heads in the lexicon. So Luigi mentioned this, but I'll just go over this quickly to remind you. We make a distinction in the current theory between lexical and functional categories. The lexical categories are nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, and prepositions. These are open class categories. You can easily invent new ones. In fact, with technological developments and so on, new nouns and verbs are constantly coming into all major languages these days, or borrowed among them. And arguably, the lexical categories are universal or close to universal. Certainly, a basic noun-verb distinction seems to hold in all known languages. Functional categories, on the other hand, are small closed class categories that convey grammatical information. So these include things like auxiliaries, in English modal auxiliaries like must or the verb to be, determiners such as the and a, complementizers such as if, that and for, that is subordinating conjunctions in more traditional terminology, elements that introduce complement clauses. These are closed class. New ones do come into the language now and then, but very slowly. They're very, very rarely borrowed from one language to another. And you can't just, you know, invent a new one on the fly the way you can invent a new noun if you want to. And they also vary enormously from language to language. I've given English examples here, but there are some of these, these categories vary across languages, and some of them arguably don't exist in certain languages. So, for example, Chinese, once again, lacks definite and indefinite determiners. It's debatable whether Chinese has anything clearly identifiable as a complementizer. The counterparts to auxiliaries are very different to familiar Indo-European languages in a number of ways. So this is where we find the variation. And this is what the Borea-Chomsky conjecture essentially states. But it states it in terms of this notion of formal feature. So what are the formal features? That is obviously a question we have to ask and try to provide a good answer to. Well, typically, in introductions to linguistics and textbooks, you'll see a list like this. Person features, first, second and third. Number features, singular and plural, perhaps dual in some languages. Case features, such as nominative, accusative and so on. Categorical features, noun and verb or N and V. And features determining movement. So we could argue that in English there's a feature of some kind that causes the WH movement operation that we saw, which is absent in Chinese. In French, there's a feature of some kind that causes verbs to move to the T position, which is absent in English, and so on, and so on. But what's the so on here, right? This list is at best incomplete. Nobody doubts that. And it's clearly an extensional definition. It's just a list, okay? Which is in some deeper theoretical sense unsatisfactory. What would an intentional definition of formal features look like? Well, it would have to have a form, you might think of this as a Taskian form if you're familiar with that literature. It might have a form like this. F is a formal feature of universal grammar if and only if P. Okay? And so then the question is, what is the content of P? Right? That's the nub of the intentional definition. At present, we don't have a clear answer to this question. And this, I think, is a problem for the theory as it currently stands, arguably a very serious problem. Why? Well, because it arguably undermines the Borea-Chomsky conjecture, since without a definition of this kind, no real predictions can be made as to the limits to cross-linguistic typological variation. Okay. It also weakens the 20 questions theory of language acquisition. And while it is clear that features such as agreement and case, so person, number, case, relate to the content of inflectional systems in very many languages, including languages with a very impoverished inflectional system such as English, and that inflectional systems are the locus of a great deal of cross-linguistic variation, the Borea-Chomsky conjecture does not prevent the postulation of arbitrarily strange features as it stands. Right? Here's an example. I'll get to an example in a moment. It relates to the nature of merge. Since Luigi went through this, we can perhaps go through this fairly quickly. So merge basically takes two elements and forms a set which can be interpreted as a little piece of syntactic structure from those two elements. The operation, as Luigi said, is recursive. So if we call the thing XY, formed by merge, if we call that Z, then we can apply merge again, merge W and Z, and that will give us a structure where W, with a set containing W and the set XY, which is a kind of hierarchical structure. Okay. And arguably, you can't get any simpler than this. We could think of merge... So the crucial point here is that binary merge is arguably the simplest possible form of merge. We could have unary merge. So merge X just forms the set containing just X. But that's no use for a theory of syntax because it doesn't combine anything. So we need at least binarity to combine things. Binary merge, therefore, is maximally simple. N-arity for n greater than 2 is intrinsically more complex. But what prevents us, from, in terms of the Baryer-Chomsky conjecture, from postulating a crazy formal feature such as plus or minus n-ary merge? Why don't we allow that some languages don't have binary merge, but n-ary merge, while other languages, say English and French, have binary merge only? A positive value for that feature would allow multiple merge to a single head, creating a flat structure of any number of categories, but with no hierarchy among them. Now, this was once thought to exist. It was once thought that there was a class of languages known as the non-configurational languages. A very famous example was the Australian language Walbury, which was discussed and analysed by Ken Hale, who was a linguist at MIT at the time, and a colleague of Chomsky's. And Chomsky, in fact, took up the idea too. So for a while in the 1980s, people talked about a configurationality parameter. So Walbury and many other Australian languages and many indigenous languages of North America and elsewhere were thought to be non-configurational, having flat structures, while our familiar Indo-European languages, or at least certainly the Germanic and Romance languages, were thought of as configurational. However, with time, essentially every language that had been thought to be non-configurational, having flat structures, showed properties of binary branching. To go into how that was demonstrated is rather complex, but now the conclusion in mainstream generative grammar is that the notion of non-configurationality is irrelevant, essentially. There are no non-configurational languages. All languages have binary branching phrase structures generated by binary merge. Therefore, we want to rule out F here, right? But the Baryer-Chomsky conjecture as it stands can't do that. It's a formal feature of a functional head, so why not? So we need to do something about this. So this brings me then to the present work, to develop an alternative to the Baryer-Chomsky conjecture, which addresses this problem. So we need to restrict the set of features to which the Baryer-Chomsky conjecture or whatever replaces it actually applies. We need to rule out crazy features like plus or minus n-ary merge in a principled way, while, of course, still providing an account of attested variation, for example, in inflectional systems. And ultimately, of course, we'd like to give an intentional definition of formal features. This is what we're doing. So let me come now to our proposal. So the proposal is that the two key notions that define parameters are redundancy and deficiency. I'll explain what that means. So most of the time, there's basically a one-to-one correspondence between form and meaning. This is an idea that has its roots in Saussure's notion of the linguistic sign. So, for example, we can say that the word dog means chien. Okay, here I'm following a noble 17th century tradition of taking French to be the language of thought. So words like dog, hund in German, cane in Italian, key in Welsh, all mean chien, or perhaps some logical formalism in formal semantics that corresponds to that. And similarly, cat in English, katze in German, gatto in Italian, cath in Welsh, all mean sha. Okay, but of course, if we look into the grammatical words, we can say, well, we suddenly this one-to-one correspondence disappears almost immediately. So in English, for the definite article, we have the invariant the. But in German, the definite article has a whole bunch of case number forms, der, die, das, den, dem, des. In Italian, it has several forms, some of them phonologically conditioned, il, I, la, le, gli, lo. In Welsh, there's just a. So all of those correspond to le in the language of thought, which has a logical representation, something like that. And of course, we also know that there are languages where there's no definite article at all. Russian, Latin, Chinese. And then there are languages where there's no opposition between definite and indefinite articles. So Welsh has the definite article, but no indefinite article. Same in Hebrew, same in Icelandic. So this is where we see the variation. So our approach then is to say that there are two key notions behind parametric variation. The first is redundancy, and we can define redundancy like this. A feature is redundant if it involves a many-to-one form-meaning relation, i.e. if at least one of its occurrences is invisible to the syntax-semantics interface. And a feature is deficient if there is a zero-to-one form-meaning correlation, i.e. if it is silent, in other words, invisible to the syntax phonology interface. So we can say, well, definiteness is a universally given formal feature, which is redundantly marked in German and Italian, as we saw, because there's a many-to-one form-meaning correlation in those languages, in different ways redundant, and deficiently marked in Russian because it's not overtly marked by articles. So it then follows that we can say definiteness is a formal feature because cross-linguistically it shows both redundancy and deficiency. There are two immediate positive consequences to this. First, merge is clearly neither redundant nor deficient, and so it cannot be parameterized. So that rules out our crazy feature, which the Baryshnikov-Chomsky conjecture couldn't do. Second, lexical categories are equally neither redundant nor deficient, so we immediately understand why parametric variation is limited to functional categories, which the Baryshnikov-Chomsky conjecture simply stipulated. But now we can see why that's the case. Okay, so now let's move on to some case studies. How long should I speak for, Luigi? But anyway, let's look at some case studies, and let's begin with the null subject parameter that we saw earlier. So a class of null subject languages represented by the Romance null subject languages, such as Italian, have rich agreement, as it's called, in that each combination of person and number, so first, second, third, singular and plural, has almost distinct inflectional realization in almost all tenses. So, for example, the present tense of the verb bere, to drink, is bevo, bevi, beve, beviamo, bevete, bevono. We find something similar in Greek, also a null subject language. And we find something similar in Albanian, also a null subject language. These paradigms, then, are neither deficient nor redundant. Right? There is just about a one-to-one mapping between each person number combination and a form of the verb. In non-null subject languages, here's German, ich trinke, du trinkst, er trinkt, wir trinken, ihr trinkt, sie trinken, you can see that that one-to-one relation is just not there. In English, it's even more egregious. There's only one distinct form of the verb, the third person singular, he drinks. The other forms are all, in fact, zero. So we can see then that these systems are redundant and deficient in various ways. So, and in fact, a German linguist, Gerian Müller, proposed 20 years ago now that null subjects cannot be licensed, are not allowed, in languages which have agreement paradigms which show what he called system-defining syncretisms. And so this basically applies, it certainly applies to both English and German. It does not apply to Italian, Greek and Albanian, as we saw earlier. What does system-defining syncretism really mean? Well, Müller proposed that these are created, these syncretisms, by what are known as impoverishment rules. And impoverishment rules are simply rules which delete features in the morphology. So in German, there's a syncretism between first and third person in the plural. Okay, and that's actually true for all German verbs, including the verb to be. In English, there's a great deal more impoverishment of this kind. So first and second person in contemporary English are always zero. Third person is zero in the past and zero in the present plural. So we can say that these features are deleted in those contexts. So impoverishment rules delete features and thereby create deficiency. So this is a domain of parameterization. So deficiency plays a fundamental role in the null subject parameter. The functional heads bearing person number agreement features must not be deficient in null subject languages. Okay. And in fact, here we can introduce, this is some very new work that I've been doing on my own. We can bring in a very interesting idea. This is the tolerance principle proposed by Charles Yang, who I mentioned earlier. So he basically, in his 2016 monograph, put forward this notion, the tolerance principle. So let R be a rule applicable to n items of which e are exceptions. R is a productive rule if and only if the number of exceptions is equal to or less than theta n, where theta n is n over the natural logarithm of n. Okay? Now, we can apply this to null subject languages. This is something I've been doing just recently. So take R to be the rule that all person number combinations must have distinct exponents of person and number features, maximally rich agreement. N is therefore 6. Six person number combinations. The exceptions E are non-distinct person number forms. Such forms violate the rich agreement rule or principle just stated. If we apply this to, from the previous slide, to a six-cell person number paradigm, we have the following. Theta n is 6 over the natural logarithm of 6, which is 1.79, so that comes out to 3.35. Okay, so that tells us that four non-distinct forms means no null subjects, which is what you see in English and German, but not in Italian. Okay, but it's actually, we can take this a step further. Let's look across tenses. So Italian has seven synthetic tenses: the present, the imperfect, the passato remoto, the future, the conditional, the present subjunctive, and the imperfect subjunctive. Okay, so there are 42 person number slots, 6 times 7. Theta n for 42 is 11.23. Okay. Of the 42 forms in Italian, 37 are distinct morphologically. So E is 5, which is less than 11.23. So that number of that amount of non-distinct forms is tolerated by the tolerance principle. So rich agreement is productive. Compare French, which has 6 synthetic tenses, if we exclude the imperfect subjunctive, which is moribund in the contemporary language. So theta n is 10.06. But there's a lot of phonological and morphological syncretism across those forms in French. So there are just 15 distinct forms. So e is 36 minus 15, 21, which is more than 10.06. So the transparency principle characterizes French as lacking rich agreement, and French is a non-null subject language. German has 4 synthetic tenses. So n is 24, theta n is 7.5, but there are 10 distinct forms, only 10, so e is 14, so German is correctly predicted to be a non-null subject language. It's not worth doing the calculation for English because it's just obvious. Okay, so I've done it, actually, but I didn't put it on the slides. In fact, the transparency principle makes very accurate predictions regarding rich agreement and null subjects in every case. A particularly interesting one, which I haven't put on the handout here, is it correctly distinguishes European Portuguese from Brazilian Portuguese. Brazilian Portuguese emerges as having impoverished agreement and is tending to change in the contemporary language towards being a non-null subject language. This is actually important because the fact that the tolerance principle gives us very accurate results is, I think, very interesting in itself. But the premise that the rule is that person number combinations must have distinct exponents is important because it implies that the universal grammar default is maximum specification of those features. And we can then think that the role of in acquisition of a language such as English or German, the child learns that there is not that maximal exponents, and thereby the system is incompatible with null subjects. This applies to languages which have such features to begin with. We could, for example, think that languages entirely lacking inflection of this kind, such as Chinese, lack such features to begin with. But in any case, poor agreement and non-null subjecthood follow from impoverishment rules, which create deficiency. Okay, now let's move on to verb movement. And here I want to report very briefly some results of very important work by an Italian linguist, Norma Schifano, who's based in Birmingham in England. She started from the opposition between French and English that I mentioned earlier with the Harry Potter examples. But she pointed out, well, the standard assumption in the generative literature was, until her work, that all the Romance languages were like French. Now, that is true in a way. But if we look more carefully at different classes of adverb, we see interesting micro differences among the Romance languages. So here, if we compare the position of the verb in relation to modal adverbs in a medial position, such as probablement, probably, of course in French the verb obligatorily precedes the adverb, but not in Italian, or in Portuguese, European Portuguese, or in Spanish. Okay, so we see a difference there. If we look at a different set of adverbs, such as aspectual adverbs, like already, again in French the verb clearly precedes the adverb, and in Italian, but not in Portuguese, here we have the order já sabe, and not in Spanish. Okay. If we take another class of aspectual adverbs, always, again the French pattern is consistent, the verb precedes. Italian, the verb precedes. Actually, it can follow in some varieties. I think that was an error there. It follows in Portuguese and it follows in Spanish. So the order is, again, sorry, those examples aren't quite right. The basic conclusion from Schifano's work is that the French verb precedes all adverbs, the Italian verb follows modal adverbs but precedes aspectual adverbs, the Portuguese verb finds itself in between different classes of aspectual adverb, and the Spanish verb follows all of these adverbs. So Schifano proposes a structure for the clause where we have separate positions for agreement, mood, tense, and different kinds of aspect, perfectivity and progressivity. And what we see is that the French verb raises to a position which is high enough to precede all of the modal, temporal, and aspectual categories, which contain these adverbs optionally. The Italian verb follows the mood position but precedes everything else. The Portuguese verb is in the middle. The Spanish verb is in the lowest aspectual position, although it still precedes certain very low aspectual adverbs like completely. Another very interesting observation that Schifano makes is that the extent of verb movement is inversely correlated to the richness of mood tense aspect inflection. So French, for example, lacks a fully productive subjunctive and in the spoken language lacks a simple past tense. Northern regional Italian lacks a synthetic past tense. It's like French, the periphrastic form is used instead of the simple past. But the Ibero-Romance languages use a synthetic past tense, have very productive subjunctives, and they differ slightly in the interpretation of the perfect. So Schifano basically says these differences correlate to the different heights of verb movement. So here again, then, we can think that impoverishment is at work in defining the languages which have the less productive morphology. So arguably in French we have two impoverishment rules, one which eliminates the subjunctive in lexical verbs and one which eliminates past tense in lexical verbs. Northern region and Italian only has the second of these two, the subjunctive is productive. Spanish and Portuguese lack both. As I said, they differ regarding the perfect, which we don't need to go into here. And French has the most verb movement, with the poorest instantiation of tense mood aspect inflection. Spanish is the opposite on all counts, and Italian and Portuguese represent intermediate cases. Okay. The crucial thing here is that we can say then that impoverishment rules are at work in defining these differences. The impoverishment rules lead to deficiency. So again, this is our notion of parametric variation. Okay, looking now again at English versus French, here was the basic contrast. Harry and Hermione often follow Filch. Harry et Hermione suit souvent Hussard. So English lacks verb movement entirely, and the reason for this is that English verbs lack mood and aspect inflection entirely and only show a very rudimentary tense marking. In this respect, English is almost like Chinese. But those features, though, mood and aspect features, are present in the grammar of English. It's just that they're morphologically instantiated in a very different way. They never show up on main lexical verbs. But, of course, the auxiliary system, which in English is quite rich, do have such features. And, in fact, it was noticed many years ago by Joe Emmons that the auxiliaries have and be in English do move. So, and we can see this in relation to adverbs like often. So if we take the progressive aspect in English, Harry and Hermione are often following Filch. That's the natural order. Okay, so the be precedes the adverb, or in the perfect, Harry and Hermione have often followed Filch. Again, the natural order is for have to precede often. So English auxiliaries behave like French verbs. That was really Emmons's old observation. They instantiate those features, which main verbs do not in English as a matter of morphology. So again, then, we see that deficiency in the form of impoverishment rules plays a fundamental role in determining verb movement parameters. Okay, I think I'll skip the section on voice because it's rather complex. Dalina Kaluja and I have a whole paper. Actually, here, the Albanian voice system is particularly complex, so we perhaps won't go through that here for time reasons. I can come back to it in the question period if need be. Let me move on to word order. Because we mentioned that earlier. So remember, we had the head parameter. This is just repeated from the earlier slide. So a head and a complement form a constituent. They're merged together to form a constituent with order not specified at the universal level. And the head parameter then arguably determines whether the head precedes or follows its complement, giving the basic typology distinguishing English-type languages, Romance-type languages for that matter, from languages such as Japanese, Korean, and so on. Well, I'd now like to suggest an alternative to the head parameter, and this follows, again, Luigi alluded to this in his talk, this follows proposals by Richie Kane to the effect that, in fact, there is a universal underlying order of head and complement, which is head initial. Head final orders of the kind we see in many languages result from the movement of the complement around the head. So if the object moves around the verb, we have a structure like this. Okay, that gives us object-verb order. If the verb moves, this operation is sometimes called roll-up, if the verb rolls up around tense, we get a structure like this one, and if we think of auxiliaries as being situated in the tense position, then this will give us verb, or actually VP, auxiliary order. So head-final languages generalize these kinds of movement rules. That was essentially proposed by Kane 30 years ago. But what triggers complement movement? That then becomes, if we adopt this approach, that becomes the question for understanding cross-linguistic word order variation. Well, remember we had merge earlier, and again Luigi talked about it. As Luigi said, merge basically forms a simple piece of structure. But the question is, what category is that structure? Merge, as we've formulated it, says nothing about that. Okay, so if we exclude on simplicity the possibility that the label of the category is just extrinsic, in other words, it's any old thing that you just want to add, if we exclude that on simplicity grounds, then we can say, well, it has to be one of X and Y that provides the label for the structure formed by merge. And in fact, there's labeling, determining which of X and Y provides the label and when, has been a focus of a great deal of technical work in the past 15 years or so now, beginning with a couple of very influential papers by Chomsky. Again, Luigi has at least one paper on it, probably more than one, I think, right? Okay.
One main paper.
one main paper, and various people have worked on it quite a bit. Basically, if we take that structure, that binary structure formed by merge, what Chomsky proposed is that when one of the categories is minimal, in other words, where one of the categories has no internal structure, that's the one that provides the label. So, for example, where we have the head-complement combination, where the complement is a phrase, in other words, it's something which has already undergone an operation of merge to form something complex, so it's not minimal, but X is minimal, then in that case, X provides the label. And this really reconstructs the traditional notion of head. Okay. Clearly, when we have that order, that situation, we get verb-object, verb-prepositional phrase, preposition-noun phrase, auxiliary verb phrase, etc. For object-verb order, we have to raise YP around X to form another category, which here I've just called alpha to give it a name for the moment. But what makes YP move? What provides the label for alpha in that structure? Well, again, a proposal going back to Chomsky's pioneering work on this is that when we have two non-minimal categories, two phrasal categories that are merged, then the label has to come from some feature that they share. Okay, and actually the same will go for complex heads, which I won't go into here. So then we can say, well, final heads have a shareable feature. So in the case where we move VP around T, we can say, well, alpha is a verbal projection because tense is, in a clear intuitive sense, verbal. And often that position, as I mentioned, is a position that auxiliaries, which are a kind of defective kind of verb, sit in. But what about object verb order? Well, it's not an accident here that I've marked the object with accusative as having an accusative feature, because here I'd like to adopt a proposal by the Japanese linguist Mamoru Saito, who suggests that case cannot label. Therefore, in that situation, alpha must be VP. Okay, case-marked elements are unable to label. Saito gets a number of really interesting consequences out of this, so I'd like to adopt that idea. Generally speaking, final heads must share a feature where they can, leaving case aside. So we can think of them as intuitively weak. Strong heads, which can label alone, typically have giving head initial order, typically have morphological exponents. So we can think then that we can adopt a concept from language typology of head-marking languages. That is, languages in which, for example, the verb or the tense or the auxiliary marks agreement. And those then would be strong heads. Therefore, by the way we've construed complement movement as applying or not as a function of labeling, those would be head-initial languages. Weak heads, which must share a label and so appear following their complements, lack morphological marking, but their complements have it. These are what are called dependent marking languages. So now we can pick up on some very interesting work in language typology, beginning with work by Joanna Nichols in 1986, which introduced the distinction between head and dependent languages. And she showed that there is a correlation between head marking and head initiality and dependent marking and head finality. Also, in fact, the pioneering paper in language typology, Greenberg 1963, of the 45 universals he put forward in that paper, universal 41 states, if in a language the verb follows both the nominal subject and nominal object as the dominant order, in other words, if the order is object-verb, the language almost always has a case system. That is consistent with what we're saying. So weak heads are intuitively deficient and case-marking. And we also mentioned, actually this was in the section on voice, that case itself is always redundant in the sense that case is not a semantic concept. It's a purely morphosyntactic concept. So again, then, we see that redundancy and deficiency are central for determining word order variation. So what I've... just come back quickly to WH movement, comparing English and Chinese again. In the English example, The WH head, which is occupied in main clauses by the auxiliary do, that's just an extraneous complication of English. But the WH head is weak, and so WH marking is dependent. But in Chinese, the WH head can be occupied by the WH particle ne, and so it's strong. So WH marking is head marking in Chinese. And in fact, Cheng 91, linguist who followed up on Huang's work on this difference between Chinese and English and extended it to many other languages, came up with the generalization that a clause must be typed, in other words, marked as interrogative, either by movement or by head particles, which is exactly what we see in the Chinese-English contrast here. And that now reduces to different strategies for labelling the clause, depending on the strength of the WH head. And it can be formulated in terms of head versus dependent marking. And then just as a last point, this is some earlier work by Dalina Kaluli, which we picked up on more recently. In English, there's an intriguing little paradigm involving so-called existential sentences with the dummy pronoun there. So you can the normal thing here is that there does not agree with the subject. That is, there as a subject does not agree with the verb or the auxiliary. Instead, it's the post-verbal NP that does. So we have things like, there are students in the room. Changing are to is, in other words, putting the auxiliary in the singular, is ungrammatical unless the auxiliary is contracted. So there is students in the room is ungrammatical. There's students in the room is grammatical. This is a very, this is my native judgment, but many other English speakers, it's a very clear judgment, actually. Well, Kaluli proposed way back that actually that apostrophe S in C is not a reduced form of is, but it's a reduced form of has. And this makes those examples comparable to French sentences like il y a des étudiants dans la salle, or Spanish, hay estudiantes en la sala. What we proposed is not that S is has, but it's actually neutralized. It's a neutralized auxiliary between have and be, and it has an optional locative feature. That's because there's a tradition of work on the distinction between have and be words cross languages, which says that have is associated with an abstract notion of location, whereas be is not. So let's say then that have auxiliaries have a lock feature, be auxiliaries lack them, therefore the neutralized auxiliary optionally has a lock feature. Now, in the sentence, there are students in the room, we have agreement in number. We can think that there is abstractly plural. The phi here just means number, in this case. And then in the sentence, there's students in the room, the reduced auxiliary has a locative feature, and there intrinsically has a locative feature, which seems reasonable. In there is students in the room, is has a number feature, there has a locative feature, they don't agree. Therefore, the sentence is ungrammatical. And actually, here we can think that is the head of the sentence, the T element, and there is, in the specifier of the head, it's a non-head element. Those two, so we have an XPXP structure, XPYP structure of the kind we saw earlier. And so there's a failure of XP and YP to share features, and so the whole sentence fails to be labelled, whereas in A and B, it can be labelled. So that's what this says. We have actually YPXP subject predicate structure without a shared feature, so labelling fails. Then we conclude in the work we've done on this, as I said, that this apostrophe S is a neutralised have be auxiliary, probably the only one in modern standard English, but non-standard English has a negative auxiliary which is completely neutralised between have and be, and that's ain't, which you may have come across and which I was told off for saying when I was in school. It's very strongly normatively proscribed, but everyone says it. And also, in Southern Italo-Romance, there are various auxiliaries which appear to neutralise have and be. So neutralised auxiliaries are certainly found. And neutralised auxiliaries are deficient, okay, by our definition of deficiency. They don't tell us whether it's have or be. Okay, so to conclude, we see that our approach, this redundancy and deficiency-based approach, avoids certain problems with the Breyer-Chomsky conjecture. But it can still do a lot of work for us in relation to the null subject parameter, verb movement parameters, voice parameters, which we didn't see, word order variation, and WH movement. So then we can come back to our intentional definition and say F is a formal feature of universal grammar if and only as F is redundant and or deficient. Okay, and that leads us to a conjecture which we modestly called the Kaluli-Roberts conjecture, which is that all parameters of variation are attributable to redundancy and or deficiency of formal features of the functional heads of the lexicon. Of course, this can also be seen as a refinement of the Breyer-Chomsky conjecture rather than a rejection or refutation of it, but we think it's a refinement that's needed for the reasons I gave and that is potentially very productive. So, voilà, merci beaucoup.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.